I didn't know if anyone was going to come back this week after last week. How did those of you who were here last week, how was it last week to spend the whole hour and a half or from 7 to 8:30 in practicing? Does anyone want to remember at all? Or maybe none of those people came back.
In fact, I attempt to take a long walk every day, and that gave me the idea of walking meditation. And I think it's also good to sometimes wear things.
Great. Thank you.
I found it got harder and harder from what I was used to standing where it was hard to concentrate, and then walking it was very hard to focus on. But during the week, it's been easier to bring myself back into myself as I was going through all those motions. So that was a really good way to start.
Great, thank you. Yes?
I think I told you last week I was mad. Because I had been on a trip, and you were not on a trip. And I built myself up all week that I was going to come, and I was like a little bit down, and I was going to hear this great words of wisdom that were going to keep me for the whole week. And then there was no speaking. And so I just couldn't believe it because I came like a little bit late. And so I don't know if you announced at first what you were going to do. And each time I kept thinking, well, now he's going to talk. It's only 15 minutes. And you never did. And so it was a lot to deal with, really wanting something and having it be different. And it was a really good lesson for me.
Good, great. So it worked. So, yes?
If we weren't here last week, what exactly happened?
I'm not sure what happened, hey? But I know what I led. Was rather than giving a talk at 7:30, you sit from 7 to 7:30 usually, and then I gave a talk and there's some discussion. We sat, I had everybody stand when we first started around, you know, at 7 o'clock or so. And we did standing meditation for 15 minutes. Because standing meditation is one of the classic ways of meditating in our tradition, but we never teach it here. I never teach it before. So I thought it'd be nice to teach it. And then after 15 minutes or so of doing standing meditation, then we did the normal, I think it was 25 minutes of sitting meditation. And then after that, we did 15, 20 minutes of walking meditation. And then we might have done some more standing meditation, I don't remember, but then we did some more sitting meditation. And then we went home. Some people went home angry, and some people went home... some people went home... you know, challenged, and some people went home contented. It's probably not any different than how it usually is. So just different people. We kind of stirred it up in different ways. So it's a wonderful thing to give oneself a chance to, for a longer period of meditative practice, not just simply for half an hour at a time. And it doesn't have to be a long stretch of just sitting meditation, which is what most people think of meditation being. But it could also be the walking meditation, standing meditation. It can be washing dishes meditation. But to do it really in the spirit of in the meditative spirit, to really, what's important is to be really present for what you're doing, and in a way that allows you to settle and become calm and intimate with yourself. Now, some people, when they extend the period of time in which they practice, will be challenged for various reasons. And being challenged in meditation is not necessarily a sign that that necessarily your meditation is bad. It means that you're meeting yourself, that you're confronting and meeting some aspect of your mind, of yourself, which normally you don't meet. And so there's a chance for you to kind of confront that and resolve with it, deal with it, work with it. And a very important part of this mindfulness practice is not just simply becoming calm, but really having a very, very deep confrontation, very, very deep meeting with yourself. You know, many of us operate on a good part of our life on semi-conscious or even unconscious motivations and intentions. And we can go through a whole lifetime not seeing what actually drives us, what actually makes us tick, and what causes at the root of our being, what causes us to react and respond in certain ways. And one of the advantages of a longer stretches of practice is it begins revealing to us, showing to us quite clearly what it is that makes us tick, what makes us work, in ways that, as I just said, is often quite invisible to us. And as we meet these deeper parts of ourselves, it's not always easy to do that. And often it can be areas of pervasive fear, pervasive anger, or insecurity, or tremendous desire and lust, or it can be all kinds of, a whole bunch of stuff we're not used to seeing about ourselves that we meet. Some people, when they meditate and meet these parts of themselves, will think, oh, the meditation is not working. I haven't gotten into some great state of bliss and calm, and so therefore I'm a failure of meditating, and I shall try something else. But actually, in our school of practice, actually to meet yourself that way deeply is a doorway to deeper peace. And to avoid really seeing yourself deeply and have a peace that, or a calm that is kind of on the side of that, it's just temporary measure. It's kind of like putting a bandage over your life. And what we really want to do is get down to the root of what makes up our being. So having a longer stretch of time sometimes pulls out, brings out aspects of ourselves which can be challenging. And some of you were challenged last week. And it can also give a chance for the wonderful settling process to work further. Many of us live in this, in a kind of surface consciousness of our mind, and we're very much involved with the busyness of our life and all the different preoccupations of our mind, and we're kind of living on the surface chatter of the mind. And a longer stretch of time sometimes gets a chance for all that surface chatter to fall away, and we get to see some other depths of who we are, not necessarily difficult depths of ourselves, but maybe some of the great beauty inside of each of us. And that has a chance to come to the surface. There are some people who never really know how beautiful they are because they live in the surface chatter, the surface judgments of who they think they are, and all the ways that we've kind of internalized other people's ideas of us or what we should be like. So the longer stretches of meditation for sometimes can really allow us to meet parts of ourselves which are normally strangers to us. And it's very, very valuable to do that. I gave an analogy a few weeks ago. I was talking about being on retreat, teaching on retreat. And a common experience for me is that on retreat, when as a teacher, as people will come and talk to me about their practice, and some people will come and actually will report how they say, oh, I'm really a good meditator right now. It's really working well. I'm really calm or blissful, or I have some great visions, or something very wonderful is happening. And, you know, it seems like I'm really practicing well now. And I'll say, that's great. And then someone else will come in to and they'll say, you know, it's really hard for me. I don't think I'm a good meditator at all. I hardly know what I'm doing here. I'm just struggling with all this, tremendous feeling of grief and regret, that they're feeling, or they're struggling with this really, this mind which is so distractible, just bounces around like a crazy monkey swinging from trees, or I'm just really struggling with, something or other, and I just can't be mindful. I'm just so struggling so much just to be, And I say, oh, is that so? And what often, not always, but what sometimes happens is that the analogy is like this. Imagine that you're out in a rowboat in some wonderful, pristine, calm, alpine lake. It's just really beautiful, and, you see wonderful mountaintops all around, and there's a nice current around the edges of the lake, and you're going with the current, and you dip your oars into the water, and you kind of hardly have to push at all. You actually don't have to do anything with the oar because the current will bring you along. And so it's just really great. It's really blissful, right? In this wonderful, peaceful place. We all want peace, right? So it's nice. And then someone else goes out to maybe in the same lake or maybe out in the ocean, and it's a huge tempestuous storm and huge 15-foot waves. It's throwing the boat back and forth and around, and And you know, they have to use all their force. There's no current helping. They used all their force, you know, to kind of get the boat moving. And each time you push the oars, it gets maybe, you know, like half an inch forward. And then you have to do the next one. It goes half an inch forward. You know, and you hardly make any progress at all. You feel like you're not getting anywhere. So eventually, both rowers make it to shore. Which one do you think is stronger? Has gotten stronger? Right? The one who was out there in the big waves got a lot stronger. And it's often that way in meditation practice, is that when we meet with great challenges and struggles in our life, that, and also this is true in our life, not just meditation, that what it calls forth within us, the ability to tell the truth, the ability to stay present, the ability to be compassionate or forgiving, the ability to simply meet the moment, the difficulty, the struggle. In the moment, it might not seem to be getting any benefit from the moment. We're just in the struggle. But the fact that we're engaging with that struggle as honestly and completely as we can, we're actually building a kind of muscles of mindfulness, muscles of honesty, muscles of equanimity perhaps, muscles of forgiveness, muscles of self-understanding. All kinds of stuff is happening in that context. And in times when life is really smooth and easy, really blissful, nice, sometimes those times we might conclude, oh, I'm just really the hottest spiritual person on the block. But actually, maybe actually atrophying your muscles. Who knows? It might not really be for that beneficial for you in those kinds of states. In general, with a life based or practice based on mindfulness, Buddhist practice, it's best not to judge how good or poorly you're doing in the practice. It doesn't really matter so much whether you think you're good or bad, or you think you're successful or not. What's important is simply that you sustain it and continue with the practice day after day. It's the continuity of practice which is really brings great power to our lives. So in that spirit, I wanted to talk about one of the aids to mindfulness practice, which some people find very helpful. It's not a necessary part of mindfulness. Some people don't like doing this, so you should know that it's optional. But it's been very helpful for many people. Now, the simplest definition of mindfulness might be to allow all things to be while being fully aware of what it is you're allowing to be. For example, when you sit here and meditate, to allow your thoughts, your emotions, your feelings, your body sensations, your breath, to let it be. Just get out of the way the best you can. Just, you don't have to judge it or do anything about it. Just let it be. Allow it to unfold as it wants. We say in our practice that we give ourselves unconditioned, radical permission to just to be as we are. Depressed, angry, happy, sad, joyful, whatever. Whatever is okay. What the practice is, in addition to allowing things to be, and this is really important, this is what makes it okay to do this, is you have to very carefully know what it is that's happening. To allow all things to be. And for some people, that's a great relief to allow things to be. But you have to add the other piece, to recognize, to know, oh, this is what's happening right now. And the nature of awareness in its simplicity is just allow things to arise and pass in awareness itself. Awareness doesn't require anything of the things it's aware of. Isn't that a wonderful thing? Have you ever thought about that? That your awareness, your ability to be aware and to know what's happening in the present moment, doesn't require anything to be different than what's already happening. It's our judgments, our ideas, our impulses, our emotions, our feelings. There's all the other aspects of our life which then react to what we're aware of. But the awareness itself doesn't need anything to be different than what it is. Part of that awareness, kind of entangled with it, actually in some sense not separate from it, is our ability to recognize, to know what's happening. To know that you're listening to someone speaking right now. To know that it's, you know, you're in a room with the lights are on. to know very simple things, to know how your body is feeling right now as you're sitting here, to know what your thoughts are, your mood is, your reactions are. We allow things to be and then we know what they are. The knowing is a little bit of a cognitive experience. It's kind of like a recognition. This tool of mindfulness that I'm about to explain to you is closely connected to this cognitive ability of the mind to simply notice, oh, this is what's happening now, this is what's happening now. And this tool is called noting. Sometimes it's called labeling. Sometimes it's called naming. It's a very, very quiet way to name your experience as it's occurring. As you're being aware of something, to name it. So as you're being with your breathing and feeling the inhalations and exhalations, to subtly name in, out, or rising, falling, as you feel the rising and falling of the chest or the stomach. When you feel some body sensation, if you feel a lot of warmth coming up inside of you, or feel cool, you would just simply note it. Warmth, 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 cool, coolness. You name it. If you feel a lot of emotions, emotions are what you're aware of, you would name the emotion for what it is. Why this is a great tool is that it's an attempt to try to keep the awareness fluid, which is the nature of awareness itself. The awareness itself, left alone, is quite fluid, malleable, it flows quite freely. It allows things to arise and pass within it. Awareness itself doesn't interfere or block or freeze anything, lock onto anything. It doesn't get preoccupied with anything. Awareness itself is like this clear glass window that just allows, or mirror, it's like a mirror. It just reflects things in the mirror. But it doesn't change what's there, it doesn't adjust it, it doesn't condemn it or judge it or want more of it. If something comes in front of the mirror, it's there. When something leaves the mirror, something else is reflected in the mirror. The nature of awareness is kind of like that, the mirror-like nature of awareness. So it's quite fluid. As we go through our life, we often then latch onto things. We have certain preoccupations that we kind of latch onto and get preoccupied with. It's a wonderful word, to be preoccupied. To be preoccupied means you can't be occupied with anything else. You can't allow anything else to come in because you're kind of stuck on this kind of concern. We have certain drives. You know, I want this really bad. I need this. My 2-year-old son doesn't seem to know the difference between want and need. He uses the two words interchangeably. I want, I need. So we latch on, another way of latching on or freezing kind of onto things is by having aversion, pushing things away, not wanting things to be that way, having hate or ill will or whatever, resistance. We kind of latch on, or the mind gets gripped and frozen by our fear, by our desire, by our hate. Many different forces get the mind frozen. The function of the noting is to help us unfreeze and unstuck the mind so the mind can flow again, or to say it a different way, so it allows things to arise and pass freely within this luminous mirror-like quality of the mind. And what we do is we name very quietly, because when we're naming something quietly, we're not exactly preoccupied with it. We're not thinking about it and the meaning of it, interpretation of it, and how it reflects on me and myself and my self-identity and all that. If you feel angry, and just to feel that you're angry, just feel a simplicity of anger and say, oh, anger, anger, there's anger happening right now. That can begin unstucking the mind from all the stories and ideas around why you're angry and what you're going to do to that person and why that's happened to me once more and what I'm going to do in the future to make it better. There's all these concerns we start exploring with the mind, which then is a preoccupation. And that preoccupation is very different from the relaxed openness of mind, which is a possibility for all of us, which is much closer to the freedom that the practice is leading us to. So just name. So you're using, to name something is using our thinking. It's kind of a thought, but using a thought to name what's actually happening as opposed to letting our thoughts wander freely, which they usually are most of the time anyway, right? Wandering freely to think whatever way they want and just kind of get them, you know, preoccupied and concerned whatever we're doing. And if we maintain a steady continuity of naming, itching, itching, hearing, 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 pressure, pressure, breathing, 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 oh, remembering, 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 having a conversation in my head, seeing, seeing. And we maintain a steady continuity. We're helping the mind stay free. We're helping this, rather than latching onto something. It's kind of letting a little part of us be a little bit removed rather than stuck onto our preoccupations. And if you maintain the continuity with time, you'll learn that you'll find often that the mind gets freer and more flexible and more malleable as you go along. I'll tell a commonly told story now that I love a lot. After the Buddha was awakened, the Buddhist equivalent of the devil would come and tempt him periodically, come along. This person is called Mara. And Mara's job description is to prevent people from becoming enlightened or prevent people from enjoying their enlightenment. So Mara would come to kind of with his bag of tricks. And what was interesting always was what the Buddha did. Here's someone who's fully awakened. What would he do when Mara comes? And it's one interpretation that's what goes back to the ancient times of Buddhism is that Mara is not some real being, but rather is a personification, literary personification of inner psychic forces. So in that sense, maybe the Buddha is not different from us. But what the Buddha did when Mara came, the Buddha would never chase him away or never invite him to tea. Buddha would simply say, Mara, I see you. And that, in saying that, the Mara would always say, oh, Buddha has seen me, and run away, and go away by himself. There's something about the power of really seeing and naming, identifying clearly what's what, that frees us from the power of identification, the power of being sucked up and lost in the things that we're concerned about, our fears, our desires, or whatever. A somewhat dramatic example of this, I thought, that I'd read to you, is from a clinical article on titled Grief and Mindfulness, Grief and the Mindfulness Approach, Death, Dying, and Bereavement Counseling. It's a very interesting title. It's even more interesting than the name of the researcher. I think it's pronounced Deathridge, but it looks like it's, you know, it could be spelled a death rage, writing about bereavement counseling. So Deathridge writes, I guess he's a therapist or psychologist, one woman who was hospitalized for manic depression and schizophrenia was instructed to watch the second hand of a clock, and when her mind went off the clock, to name the distraction. Soon she realized that most of her distractions were related to the past. She was instructed to label them as remembering, remembering. With this technique, she learned to identify herself with the objective watcher of her disturbing thoughts, instead of with the depressed thinker. Soon she began to gain insight into the nature of her illness and was released from the hospital. So it's the power of naming. It's really powerful. This woman really helped this woman a lot. The Buddhist would have instructed her one step further, because here it says, with this technique, she learned to identify herself with the objective watcher of her disturbing thoughts instead of the depressed thinker. Now that's great. That's good enough, maybe. Don't want to rock the boat here. But what the Buddhist would say, okay, that's very good. Now name the objective watcher. And who named the objective watcher? And soon, pretty soon, you don't have any watcher at all. And then who are you? Another woman who was hospitalized for anxiety, depression, and inability to function adequately rebelled against any suggestion of introspection. As she was a Mormon, the word Buddhist or meditation was not mentioned. As the therapist interacted with her, it became apparent that much of her day was spent fantasizing and imagining to avoid the anxiety of her life. Much of her day was spent fantasizing and imagining in order to avoid the anxiety of her life. The habit of fantasizing was discussed with her, and then she was asked to undertake a psychological procedure. To her surprise, she was asked to bake a cake. However, she had to do it extremely mindfully, with minute attention to detail. When the persistent fantasies would arise, she was instructed to just observe them. After a while, she found she could intentionally return to the present moment and so function more adequately. She also began to gain insight into the nature of her anxiety and depression. Since most of the ways in which the mind gets stuck and frozen in resistance or desire, relate to some degree or other with fantasy, much more than most of us will admit or realize unless we do some very deep introspection. I think this was a very telling little tale here, this woman here. We get involved in these kind of fantasy-making imaginations of interpretations of what's going on. And if we can simply step out of it and see what we're doing in the present moment, imagining, remembering, fantasizing, there's a kind of freedom. The mind suddenly becomes more spacious and more at ease. And naming really helps that. What's happening now? Naming it. Naming functions another way. Most of the ways in which we relate to things, if we are relating to things in the present moment, are often through the filter of all kinds of interpretations and ideas and concepts. We have ideas of permanence, ideas of self, built into much of our interpretation, our interpretations of our experience of life. And part of what meditation is a re-education, a retraining of the mind, so it doesn't see reality so much through the filter of our interpretations, but begins to see things much more directly as they actually are. Now, all of us have had the experience, maybe, I don't know if all of us, but many people have the experience of other people putting us in a category and then always treating us through that category. We're someone's spouse, or we have a certain kind of profession, so we're always that kind of person. Or once upon a distant time, we did something unskillful to someone, and now they always think of you as this terrible person who treated them badly once. So there's some people who kind of put us in a category and hold us there. And we say, wait a minute, I've changed. I'm not that. You know, I'm much more than that. It's very easy to see how, or you can see how other people do that to themselves. You see people come to you and say, I can't do that. I don't have that ability, or I'm inadequate, or I'm unworthy, or they say the opposite, I could do that, just like that, and I'm the hottest stuff, I'm the hottest person, programmer in Palo Alto, and whatever, people put themselves in a category. It sometimes is very limiting, because we're never a category, and if we're really stuck and really hold ourselves tightly to a category and present that to the world, and present that to ourselves, we really limit ourselves dramatically. So at times it can be very easy to see it and other people doing it to us. It can be sometimes easy to see how other people do it to themselves. Guess where it's hard? It's very hard to see how we do it to ourselves, or how we do it to other people, or to things, or to situations in life. The function of mindfulness is to help loosen up, lighten up the normal fixed ways in which we see things, so we can see things not through the filter of our interpretations and our fears and our desires and our wants, but more directly for what they actually are. And what we do when we name, we use the mental noting. We're naming not the interpretation, but we're naming actually what we're experiencing. So we don't, like, for example, if you're seeing someone, you don't note, oh, that's a beautiful person. What you actually experience is experience of pleasantness. Oh, I feel pleasant now. There's a pleasant seeing that's happening now. Or if you're feeling a physical pain in your body as you meditate, to say, oh my God, you know, I bet it's cancer. I'm sure it's cancer, you know. I've never had this kind of sensation in my knee before. And this is the beginning of the end. I better find a good orthopedic surgeon or something, you know. And off we go. And you might think that your interpretations, you know, since you're kind of, they've been directing this, the show for a very long time, have a certain validity kind of built into them, right? Oh my God. And what we do in noting is we name it. We don't name, oh, the interpretation. We name, oh, the actual sensation and feeling we have. When there's an emotion, we don't name the conclusion that because of that emotion. We don't say, for example, oh, I'm a depressed person, I'm always going to be depressed. We simply feel, oh, depression is happening now. There's a big difference between the two. Depression is happening now. And what is? And then you can actually note more carefully, oh, depression. Oh, there's lethargy, there's tiredness, there's resistance. There's, you know, there's different things going on here. Actually name it, actually what it is. And when you can start naming or seeing things much more carefully as they are, there's a kind of re-education of the mind that happens. And away from ideas of permanence and fixed identity to more of idea of fluidity, of change. And to the idea that things can change, that people can change, that all things can change. And we can be more open to that change, more allowing for that possibility. And also, as we allow, as we name it, see it more directly for what it is, rather than our interpretations, we also frees us up from the burden of always associating our experiences to some idea of who I am, or who that person is, some fixed ideas. Meditation is a cure for fixidity. The idea is to find some way to have a fluid mind. It doesn't mean that we can, you know, we're naive about the things of the world, but it at least means that as we encounter the world, then learn how to engage with it and reflect on it and act wisely in it, our mind is at least at rest, is at least relaxed, is at least fluid and not stuck in its preoccupations and thoughts. So the naming is very, very powerful. And the idea is to name in a very slow and kind of, not slow necessarily, but a kind of steady, easy pace. This is what's happening now, this is what's happening now, this is what's happening now. And what's going to happen is that you meet some resistance or some frustration sometimes, because you start noting, this is what's happening now, this is what's happening now. And there's going to be a tendency to want to start thinking about that. Oh, that's a good fantasy. Let's go, you know, maybe I explore that fantasy. That would be a really nice one, you know. And that's, oh, I'm supposed to be noting. You know, something has to give. Either you're really with the fantasying or you're with the noting. The noticing what's happening. If you understand the power and the value of mindfulness, you'll choose, especially in your meditation period, not to follow the fantasy, but to follow, just go, fantasy, and it goes away, and then you're with something else. So that really the primary place where your energy is in the mindfulness, not in the way the mind stops and follows some tangential thought or concern. Have you noticed how your mind will stop and something comes up? You have suddenly some memory or some idea or some interpretation or some feeling or some emotion. Something occurs. And off the mind wanders, gallops, full speed ahead. Maybe horse language is too slow for him. Maybe, you know, it's about megahertz nowadays, right? And off the mind goes. So the noting is to keep the mind fluid, to keep the mind from rushing off on these other directions. So we can stay in the present moment, stay in the present moment, stay in the present moment. And you might sometimes notice a kind of tension as you do that, because the mind is not being allowed to wander off into preoccupations the way it usually is. And for a while, it might be a little bit difficult, like, you know, rowing the boat in that tumultuous sea that I mentioned earlier. But slowly, the mind will relax, and the strong impulses to go be distracted will begin to lessen. And you'll find the mind becomes more at ease and actually much more happy
It's actually quite hard to be happy if you're preoccupied and your mind is stuck. Happiness is really real kind of I think the most satisfying forms of happiness come when the mind is fluid and unstuck. So noting and naming really helps with that. So noting. Some people find it very awkward, especially if they meditate for some time, to use the noting in their meditation practice, because it's kind of too agitating or too busy. The mind has been used to maybe being quiet a little bit in meditation, and that's what we think meditation is, to be really quiet. And here you're suddenly using the mind, the thoughts, rather than letting things go. It's kind of an art form, and it takes a while to learn it. So if initially it feels a little bit agitating, a little bit coarse to do it, don't give up at the first sign of difficulty or awkwardness. But rather it's like learning a bicycle. It's often first awkward, you know. But after a while, you don't have to think about it. Just smooth, and you can take your hands off the handlebar, and you know, just coast along, and things are great. It's kind of like that with the noting. With time, as you learn it, you take your hands off the handlebars of noting. It just kind of goes by itself almost. And it's very quiet, very subtle, very soft function of the mind. Though some people find that it never really works for them, and so those people will never note, and that's fine. But I'd encourage you, if you've never tried, to give it a try for a while and see if it actually might help your meditation and keep you on track. It might not be, you might not discover its value right away, but you might have to do it for a few weeks to kind of see that actually it's actually keeping you much more present than your old way of meditating. Many people, when they meditate, can be a little bit fooled. Thank you for noting that.
Some people when they meditate can actually be fooled by how present they are, by actually just kind of, they think they're present, but their mind's just wandering freely, you know, and they're preoccupied and lost in their fantasies and ideas, and it's somewhat pleasant and comforting. And maybe that's what they think meditation is to be comforted, or to have some pleasant experience. Meditation is not meant to be comforting. It's meant to be liberating. So part of the art of the mental noting is to say it quietly enough, subtle enough. It's a very, very, very soft, soft whisper in the mind. But maybe you can go too soft, and that becomes kind of straining. But really soft. Most people have a sense, I think, if there can be different intensities to our thinking. You know, if someone has really just done something really terrible to you, and you are really upset and angry, and you're thinking about that event, you mean that the thoughts are just kind of, you know, really intense. And other times, you know, you've had this wonderful nap and just the right meal and wonderful kind of, you know, everything's going well in your life. The weather and temperature is just nice, and you've just woke up from this nice nap underneath an oak tree in a nice spring grass meadow, and nothing in the world is, you know, wrong. And the thoughts are really quiet and subtle, just barely kind of humming along, you know. You want to see if you can identify the most subtle level, layer of thinking that's available to you, and then note from that point. The idea is to name the experiences as simply as you can, in the most obvious labels you can. The name is actually not that important, as the function that the naming has in helping us to be present, help us from being stuck in what's happening in the present moment. One of the guidelines in our tradition is that 95% of what we're doing in meditation is feeling the experience, the felt sense of an experience, what's actually how the actual experience is. 5% of what we're doing is naming it. Sometimes the people will reverse that percentage, and that's actually problematic. If 95% of what you do is naming, then you're just kind of too much lost in your thoughts. But naming is a very kind of subtle background kind of thing you do. It helps keep the mind soft and moving and calm. And if you don't know the name of something that's happening, an emotion or a feeling in the body or whatever, then you can just use some very generic label like something. or an experience, or for a while I used to do yes to everything. Just name it yes, you know. But there is a place for being accurate, but you don't want to spend time having to reflect and think about or analyze what's the right word. If nothing obvious comes, then just go with something generic. Some people will note everything that they're paying attention to in the present moment. And some people will only note, like in the article, their distractions, the stuff that takes them away from the breath or takes them away from the present. Some people only note their thinking. Sometimes I do that way. The only thing, I'm pretty much present in a silent way sometimes when I practice. But then my mind goes off into thoughts and I'll thinking, and then I'll come back. Some people only note their emotions, because that's the place they tend to get stuck the most. So they just name it, and they tend to kind of not be so stuck. Some people won't note when they first sit down, but only when they get more settled. And some people will only note when they first sit down until they get more settled. So I'm giving you a sense, there's many ways of doing it. Maybe I shouldn't give you so many options. But the idea is that it's kind of an art form. It's kind of something you maybe even playfully and explore for yourself. How can this work for me? How can this help me? What would it mean for this to be helpful in my meditation? To have some sense of that. What would it mean for it to be helpful? Does it mean that it helps me make me be more present? Does it help me be more the objective observer? Does it help me be more kind of looser and lighter about what's happening in the present moment, more spacious about it? And have a sense, is it helping me do that? If it is, great. If it's not, if you do it for a few weeks and it's not helping you, adios. You don't have to do the noting anymore. Does that make sense? What's your reactions to that you're noting? Anything you want to ask or say about that? Yes, please.
You said that the goal is not to name the interpretations, but naming itself is necessarily an interpretation.
Yes, but it can be if we take that line of reasoning, that interpretation, then there are degrees of interpretations. So if I go like this, what I'd note is hearing. That's the actual experience, hearing. I could also get lost in my interpretations of, that was a beautiful sound of a bell, and I wonder where I can buy one of those bells. And actually, I think having a slightly bigger one would make a deeper sound. And, you know, actually, I thought it was good, but actually now I think it's not so good compared to that bigger bell that I could imagine having. So there's a world of difference between saying hearing, which might also be an interpretation in your line of thinking, and all the other imaginations that I started making. That makes sense? So we want to go back and try to be as close to the experience as we can before there's layers and layers of filters of interpretations.
It does make sense, but I want to observe that in my understanding, it's not all or nothing.
Yes.
The downsides of interpretation still exist in naming, which is two potential hazards I see. One is that you're categorizing the wrong place, whether you think I'm remembering or I'm planning. As soon as you label it, you've labeled it not the other. And second, if I notice a pain and I name it pain, I might notice the pain in my knee a second time. And by lumping them both together as pain, I'm missing a subtle variation.
Right.
Even something as broad as yes, if I notice an experience and call it yes, I might choose the inappropriate boundary of that experience. I might cut it off before the experience really completed itself.
Yes,
it's
true, that's possible. And I think it's very important as meditation gets more subtle and to have that kind of sophistication. But that level, that difficulty functions anyway, even without the naming, because the mind is already involved. In Buddhism, there's an idea that there's no such thing as pure perception, meaning perception unmediated by any kind of concepts at all. It's one of the holy grails for some meditators, just to have an experience unmediated by thought. the Buddha didn't posit that that was interesting or that was possible. So language and some degree of interpretation might always be part of our experience. The naming, might be a little bit, can be a little bit maybe more or extra than the interpretation you do without the naming. But the interpretation might be there already. And the function, so there are some dangers with this, but in that the guideline is 95% of what you're doing is actually sensing the experience, being with experience directly. Only 5% is the naming. I don't think there's so much danger. Because if it's only 5% of what you're doing is naming, you're not so caught up with the name, not so concerned about it. It's just helping keep the mind present and luminous, kind of framing the experience, helping the mind stay there with that. The borders of the names can kind of just, you know, it can change as we get to experience the thing more carefully and more deeply. Your reservations, I think, are valid. Right? The risks are pretty minor, and it's a little bit awkward for me to say this, but we don't really understand the degree to which we're attached, the degree to which the mind is stuck, until the mind has gone into very deep states of meditation, and we can think, you know, kind of a normal street consciousness, oh, I'm not stuck right now, things are just fine. You know, I'm just laying underneath this wonderful oak tree in the meadow in the springtime, and everything is fine. My mind is easy. Nothing's. There can be a tremendous amount of stuckness, of attachment, even in those pleasant states. And it's a function of deep meditation is to really get down to the roots of it and understand. So yes, if you're really not stuck, you don't need to do anything. But then you're also liberated. So there's don't give up too early. For some pseudo freedom that you might, or kind of preliminary levels of ease that you might experience. Yes.
I'm thinking of the noting as a way of sort of giving the brain something to do, but it doesn't run off as readily. Because sometimes I meditate on the train on the way to work, and sometimes the train is really noisy, so I end up concentrating with the train noises. But I feel like I almost need to intellectualize it sometimes, like while I'm thinking about the train or something. Oh, you know, there's a really high pitch and then there's a bass, you know, and then, oh, I noticed the vacuum sound. And so there's this kind of thing going, oh, aren't I clever? And that's the point of meditating is to like...
A running commentary.
Right, exactly. So I'm thinking, well, you know, in that scenario, I'm thinking, okay, you know, sound noise, high pitch noise. Cover.
Right.
I don't know.
But that was very much to the point of what I was trying to say today. Is that we have such strong tendency to wander off into our thoughts. This is actually using our thoughts to help us be more present, rather than to wander off in our thoughts and more elaborate interpretations that come with that. Yeah. Yes.
When we are having feelings, and you name the feelings. And the feeling stays with you.
Yeah. So you keep naming it.
And then what happens?
I don't know. how should I know? How should I know?
Well, would you recommend, though, that you go back to the breath?
Oh.
Would you stay with the emotion, with the feeling?
Yes. It depends a little bit on the circumstances. If an emotion is predominant, is the main thing you're experiencing, then the practice is to open to that, to be present for that, to name it, to feel it, to sense it in your body, to be with it. The usual instruction is just stay with something however long it's predominant, until you see the arising and passing of it, you see it passing away, until it dissolves and changes to something else, or something else becomes even more predominant than that. And so an emotion and the various body sensations and all that associated with it and the energies of it are fine things to meditate on. The danger with emotions is it's very easy for some of us to cross the line from feeling it as it is directly to getting involved with the judging or involved with the story making and ideas and history and memory and all that analysis. Occasionally, if an emotion is really powerful, staying present for it can actually make things more agitating for us and make us less able to be present. And then sometimes it's just useful just not to avoid that which is agitating and until you're more settled, and then you can maybe open to it later as you're more stabilized. And sometimes after being with something for a long time, you might feel like it's really acknowledged enough now and you know, it's maybe it's enough, and then you can go back to your breathing. But generally, it's to stay and kind of develop and strengthen your mindfulness on that emotion, to explore it and you can get very detailed investigation of the actual experience of an emotion, and how close can you get? You know, if it's fear, you know, where is the fear exactly in the body? You know, do you feel it in your throat? And where in your throat is it? You know, and can you, you know, oh, it's, you know, it's a little tightness kind of at the base of the throat, and you feel and sense, and you know, oh, and really, oh, it's actually it's tightness. It's actually all there, just you know, a series of different kind of flashing experiences of tightness and hardness and oh, you know, and it's kind of flashing about and oh, and it begins to dissolve and then it's gone. And I don't know if that made sense for you, but does that answer your question, you think, Mona? Yes?
Gil, I tried the noting and I did it very faithfully for a while, and I found that I was filling up my mind with not facing.
Yeah. And
I thought it wasn't beneficial for me because I was filling my mind with it, but what I noticed was that in my outside experiences, at other times when I wasn't meditating, I would suddenly be naming something and recognizing a feeling that I might have gone right by. For example, I would think, oh, I'm really feeling impatient right now. Whereas before I started naming things, I might not have noticed that myself.
Oh, I see. So it's spilled over.
Outside of meditation,
yeah.
But it didn't feel like it was beneficial inside of meditation.
Maybe so. Could be. Some people, it's interesting how the benefits of meditation for some people. Some people find a lot of benefits from meditation directly. And some people see that meditation practice itself, they do it loyally, but it doesn't seem to change anything over time. Nothing seems to, about the meditation seems to be getting any better, or, you know, just their meditation. They sit there and But they feel the rest of their life changes dramatically. And so it varies from person to person how it all unfolds. And yes, please.
I feel like I was filling up my mind with naming. Do you think that's...
Yeah, there are some dangers with a noting. I mean, others than what the gentleman here said. One is that it can become mechanical. And so we kind of get lost in the mechanics of just naming, as opposed to staying present for the lived experience of something. Also, this idea of filling the mind, if 95% of what you're doing is naming, it's kind of like just big thing you're doing, kind of, well, you know, we also lose track of the present moment experience. And that's why it's very important that the naming become very, very soft and subtle. It doesn't fill the mind, but it's more like a whisper in the back corner of the mind. I've known one or two people who I think maybe for their own psychological issues, maybe psychological difficulties, used the noting as a crutch, and they did it mechanically, regularly, like it created some order, and there was, you know, that their mind would just be out of control, and they're so afraid of being out of control that they just held on to the noting. In a day and night and everywhere, and you know, that's not the spirit. You know, it's kind of it's not supposed to be a crutch. It's supposed to connect us to what's living and moving and alive. It's not supposed to become mechanical or a crutch. So there are problems that might arise, but the problems can arise in meditation no matter how you meditate. And what's beautiful about mindfulness practice is that in that we're doing a mindfulness practice, it's self-correcting. Because you're supposed to notice what's going on. It might take a while sometimes, but eventually, after a few months.
So then as soon as it becomes easy, then we need to struggle again.
Sorry? Yeah. Oh, the analogy of the rowboat supposed to be a teaching that you're only supposed to look for difficulty or be in difficult situations. You know, please enjoy your peace when that's there. Don't go looking for trouble. Genevieve.
I was just going to say that I caught myself noting today in terms of emotions. And the hook for me in that was that by noting it would somehow get better. If I noted it, then the payoff to me would be I would start having some feelings of equanimity and serenity again. And that didn't happen. I simply noticed, you know, what was going on. And I saw how it just kept fluctuating, but I would come back to this unpleasant emotion and unpleasant state of mind. And eventually it just was a matter of coming to a place of accepting that that was where it was going to be. And it might change, it might not, you know. But it was interesting to see that little hook, that by noting somehow that gives me some ticket to feeling great.
One of the interesting uses of the noting is exactly what you said, Genevieve, is noticing the attitudes that we have towards our life or our practice or our experience that seems to be embedded in the noting itself. So another example would be if the tone of the inner voice that's doing the noting sometimes is very revealing. Because if you have, for example, some pain, you can notice very matter-of-factly, pain, which is kind of the idea. It's very softly, quiet, matter-of-factly, pain. Or you can note it, pain, you know, and there's this tremendous anger and aversion that's kind of, and the first indication you might have of this aversion to the pain might be the tone of the voice that's noting it. Or if you feel some wonderful, delightful bliss in your meditation and you note, oh, pleasure. It might indicate there's a little bit of identification with that experience that also is extra. Can you, in the same simple way, pain, pleasure, be present for both of them in the same way? That's the real challenge. It's a challenge to do that. But you'll become freer and freer when you can just simply see things and let recognize them and as they are, without adding all kinds of interpretations and identifications and aversions and desires to it. So the naming sometimes can show that. The quality, the tone of the way we note, or the expectations that we infuse it with. So I hope that this was interesting and useful for at least most of you, and that those of you for whom the noting isn't maybe relevant is... at least you learned something interesting today. Maybe not relevant for you, but for other people. And I'll be back again next Thursday. And
Thursday after that,
yeah, we'll still meet. I won't be here. I'm teaching retreat over New Year's, but. A very senior, Don Flaxman, who's a very senior Vipassana teacher, a student, and a he's kind of like an assistant teacher, perhaps, or junior teacher, or I don't know, something like that. He's a wonderful man. He's a local practitioner and wonderful person, and gives wonderful talks. So he'll be here on that, I think it's the 27th. No.
30th.
Thank you. 30th. And then I'll be back the first Thursday in January. So I'll be here next week. So also, as you know, month of December, we keep the Dana baskets and donation baskets inside the door in the back there. So please, let me say this before we end. On January 9th, which is Sunday evening, Joseph Goldstein is going to come and give a talk in Palo Alto. Joseph Goldstein is one of the founding or first Vipassana teachers in America, a very important person, very profound thinker and wonderful practitioner, a very deeply practiced person. He's one of my teachers. It's a great honor to have him come to our community. So I have some information up here if you want to learn more about it, or in the next few Thursdays we'll have more information available for that. That's at Gunn High School. It's Spangenberg Auditorium at 7 o'clock on January 9th. And so please, as if you notice during this next week that you get harried or hectic or impatient, overwhelmed, frustrated, confused by the kind of things that happen around this time of year, the holidays, see if you can note it. And see if in noting it quietly, calmly, creates some more spaciousness around it. Yes, Meg? Oh yeah, New Year's Eve. Our community will have an event. If anybody wants to go someplace New Year's Eve, at St. Mark's, which is the Episcopal Church on the other side of 600 Colorado, just down the street here, just the other side of Middlefield. And maybe in the next few weeks we'll also have information about that. But it's a little bit ecumenical. There's another meditation group that's coming and joining, and some of the people from the Episcopals will join. But it's mostly an evening of meditation, sitting and walking meditation, and some short Dharma talks, and maybe some reading of sacred literature. Some people think that some of the very best fun is sit and meditate. I've had more happiness in meditation than I think no party I've ever been to I've ever had been as happy as I've been in meditation. So it might not be your cup of tea, but yes. I think it starts at 7, but you can probably, you know, come late. It's not like you're late for anything. Just don't come after what?
You know, people be out of town before that, so they won't be able to come and find out when it's going to happen.
Yeah, just come whenever you can. 7, 8, 9, just before noon, before midnight.
That's when the really good meditation.
Yeah. And, are you silent like at midnight?
Yeah, that's the idea. There's some talking, some stuff that happens beforehand, but then as midnight approaches, we sit in meditation. This is what I'll be at Spirit Rock, and this is what we'll be doing there. Midnight approaches, we'll have a ritual earlier in the evening, and then as it approaches, we'll sit and meditate and meditate. And meditate. And at Spirit Rock, it's so far away, we might not even notice that it's midnight. But here, and this thing, you probably hear fireworks and stuff, so you'll know when it is. But it's an amazing thing, you know, New Year's Eve, because nothing actually happens. And you know, we're making so much to do about the year 2000, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the Buddhists went through year 2,500 years ago. I mean, we've been there, done that. I mean, what's the big deal? Get over it. You know, this is like the year 2,583 for the Buddhists, so I mean, what's the big deal? And yeah, even more, I mean, you know, so like, what's this big deal? And then and New Year's Eve, like, what's the beautiful things about the Bay Area? There's so many different cultures here that you could actually go around and celebrate New Year's Eve all year long, because the Jews have a different New Year's Eve, and the Chinese have a different, the Thais have a different New Year's, and there's all these different New Year's Eve. You can just, you know, pick and choose which one you like. If you miss the one that's, you know, December 31st, just, you know, that's okay. Another one's coming along.
And then there's the thing about
the year 2000, this coming New Year's is not really the beginning of the new year. The following year, because we started with the year one and not the year zero.
And all this, it's just a convention. Nothing astronomical happening at this particular New Year's. New Year's is just an idea we've invented. It's a convention. And so nothing actually happens. And in the real world, nothing happens. But in the world of our thoughts and ideas and all the things we construct from our thoughts, and there's a lot that happens. And part of the great thing about deep spirituality is to begin to appreciate that world that is real. And so we sit and meditate, noticing how actually nothing happens at midnight. Except some people with fireworks.
That freed me from worrying about how am I going to have enough fun on New Year's Eve. When I found out about this, maybe I'll go, because now I'm freed from thinking about what special thing I need to do.
I think it's a very nice thing. So it's to be at St. Mark's, 600 Colorado, that evening, and it probably starts around 7, and or 7:30. And next few weeks there'll be some more announcements. And what?
I can't remember when she mentioned it on Monday.
Yeah.
I think she said it would last till 12:16.
Yeah.
Is there some organizer, a particular person?
Yeah, Fiona Barner is organizing it, and she usually comes on Thursdays, but. Not today.
Will there be any kind of place for children to sort of crash or something like that if you want to bring the children?
I don't know about that. You might talk to Fiona.
Okay.
And ask her if she has any plans.